just a note about Tannenbaum, which we're doing this a little out of order. So there's a really great slide that explains all that we're about, but it's in another presentation you'll see later. So we'll skip past that when it comes up, but we are a secular and non-sectarian organization, so we're not religiously based. And we don't promote religion, nor do we denigrate it, but in key areas of life, we recognize that religion is a force in people's lives. And it, in healthcare, it has everything to do with the decisions that patients make based on their religious or non-religious beliefs. A quick word about some of the work that we do in healthcare. We do grand rounds, we do environmental assessments. We actually have a book that's in the back. Those are review copies. They're not to take, but we will be raffling one off at the end of all of the presentations today. And that book, the Medical Manual for Religio-Cultural Competence, covers 10 faith traditions, and it's basically part workbook, part primer for medical practitioners on some of the things to be aware of when a patient with a religious belief comes before you and some of the concerns that you may want to pay attention to. And we're in the process of making that book an ebook. So by the beginning of the year, medical practitioners will be able to use it on iPads and that kind of thing so that it's more mobile. So about, let's just see, I guess I have to do it here. Okay, that does it. Right, so I don't have any relationships to disclose either. And since there are three presentations, just remember that two more times. That I don't have any relationships to disclose, no personal financial relationships. So the first thing that we want to talk about is just religiosity, particularly in the United States, broadly defined. And the question becomes, how many religions are there? And you can see from this display, and let me just go back because I like when it does this. There really is a huge diversity of belief and practice and even culture affiliated with religion, but often our relationship to the religiosity of patients tends to be somewhat myopic. And everything about how many religions are there, the way to answer the question, has to deal with who you're asking. Some surveys will tell you that there are 72 denominations in the United States. Some surveys will say that there's anywhere between 1,500 and over 4,000 recognized denominations of Christianity. So with all of that, in addition to Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism and all of the traditions that you see on the screen, this is not an exhaustive list. This is the beginning of a much larger conversation. And the work around what we call religio-cultural competence has to do with preparing practitioners and all of those who have patient contact to be able to ask respectfully and interact with patients respectfully to find out what if any concerns they may have or how do their religious beliefs affect their decision making about their health care. In the back, there is a handout that you can take at the end of the session, and these are trigger topics. And what we identify these as are the areas where religious beliefs and or non-beliefs can intersect with the decision-making patients go through in healthcare. Dietary requirements, dress and modesty, hygiene, informed consent on the part of both the patient and the practitioner. Observance of holy days and rituals, and for practitioners, this sometimes becomes a workplace issue. Who gets to take time off and when do they need time off? And if you're observing a particular period of either celebration or reflection, might that impact your work performance? In addition to, for patients, if it's elective surgery, does it have to happen during Yom Kippur? Or if it's an evaluation, does it have to happen during Ramadan or can it wait? What's the marriage between those kinds of considerations? Traditional and alternative remedies, and I'm going to bring up a few examples of each of these for this part of the presentation. Conscience rules, reproductive issues, pregnancy and birth, end of life, which is usually the place that we automatically think about where religion intersects with healthcare. And there are so many more, as you can see, places where the religious beliefs or non-beliefs of patients actually intersect with the decisions that they make. Acceptance of drugs and procedures, proselytizing, which is an ongoing consideration, and not just from the perspective of Christianity, but in a variety of ways. And we'll talk in one of the other presentations about what we'd like to think of as a spectrum of understanding of what proselytizing is and the impact that it can have on patients. Praying with patients, organ transplants and donations, and blood products. So, end of life. A young Jewish girl is declared brain dead, medically, but the parents refuse to withdraw care. They don't view brainstem death as death. And then what becomes the conversation? So the practitioners could actually spend their time trying to convince the family that the girl is dead, which often happens in some instances, trying to find court support, legal support for withdrawing care. But does the team actually enlist either pastoral care or a chaplain or the rabbi that this family belongs to? And something to bear in mind about religious beliefs as they affect health care is that the experience of adherence, meaning quote-unquote how religious someone is, changes throughout our entire lives. And in certain circumstances, people may become more adherent in a particular tradition, change traditions, denounce their tradition. There's no way to tell. And I'm not a healthcare practitioner, but within healthcare, we want to be mindful that there is not a static experience of people's religiosity, that there is a flow to it. Acceptance of drugs and procedures. The husband of a Hmong woman with brainstem herniation refuses to allow surgery, insisting that if her lost soul was recovered, she would heal. And in this instance, what actually happened was the medical team worked with the husband. He went home to his community, performed a particular ritual to ensure that her soul would be taken care of regardless of the outcome, and then they went ahead with the procedure. So this was an instance where the team actually acknowledged and respected the beliefs of the family. Organ transplants and donations. The son of an elderly Japanese man who is brain dead agrees to donate his organs. His uncle is furious because, according to Shinto beliefs, interfering with a corpse brings bad luck and injures the relationship between the dead person and the bereaved. So this is also this also speaks to interacting with families from a religio-cultural perspective in terms of who's the decision maker. Because while the son actually gave permission, there's now discord within the family because the uncle actually has a particular standpoint on what should be done with the body. And part of the communication work that we do with practitioners has to do with identifying even though there's a legal person who signs, how do you interact with the family from a religio-cultural perspective? Okay, blood and blood products. The parents of a Jehovah's Witness child with sickle cell anemia refused to allow a blood transfusion. And Dr. Padella and I actually had dinner last night, and I was sharing a story that we're doing work with a residency training program, a pediatric residency training program in New York. And the director of the program shared with us that in one year, there was a chief resident who, upon hearing that a child was sick, the mother was there with the child, that they were Jehovah's Witness, kind of took all of the residents off medical task to actually get court clearance that if they needed a transfusion, that they would be able to do that. And they spent hours doing this. And the chief, the director of the program, while all of this was going on, was one, laughing at them, and then two, went in to speak with the mother and actually ask her. And he said that, you know, we don't see any need at this point to have to transfuse your child, but if that became a reality, would you allow that? And she said, yes, I would allow that. So here's the, you know, chief resident taking everybody off task for something that may not be necessary and, contrary to stereotype and opinion, would be acceptable for this particular patient. And one of the things that we do a lot of work on is how do you interact with an individual about their specific belief, and we distinguish it, culture, belief, and practice, that there are three components to the religiosity of a person. Traditional and alternative remedies. A doctor detects dangerously high levels of lead in the blood of two little girls. Their mother had given them a dose of Greta, a Mexican folk medicine for stomach ailments. The medication contained a high content of lead. And you have to imagine that this was an instance where, because of the protocols, the doctor was able to actually identify this. But one of the areas and why this is a trigger topic is that often people will go to their practitioners, not tell them of alternative medicines that they're using that may be contraindicative to the work that the doctor needs to do with them. And so some of the work that's necessary around religio-cultural beliefs has to do with spiritual assessments, which we actually recommend. Informed consent. A Jewish patient refuses to agree to a medical procedure until she has consulted her rabbi. And in this particular case, she gave her doctor her rabbi's number and didn't say who it was, but said, call this number. And the rabbi went through, you know, a series of questions with the person. Where did you go to school? Where were you accredited? You know, I mean, really kind of like, who are you? And what's your background? And after this series of questions, the rabbi said to the woman, go ahead with the procedure. And to many, this can be an interruption, it could be an annoyance, but there's a long tradition within the Judaic community that there is this, you know, probatory exploring of what are the options, what's available to us. I think the other thing, too, that in a focus group that we did with residents, one of the things that a resident said that I think is very important is that often within the medical experience, when people come to the hospital or come for some kind of health ailment, they're dealing with something new. Whereas from the perspective of practitioners, healthcare practitioners are dealing with illness daily. And so there really has to be some moment of connection between what patients are dealing with when they come to healthcare settings and the sensitivity is really not the word, but an awareness of the complexity of when a person gets sick and what are they dealing with, that they're not used to being sick. And some of the things that they might ask for in any other circumstance kind of go out the window. Dress and modesty. A hospital in Maine notices that Muslim women are not coming in for care. They discover that it's due to immodest gowns. And I think to this hospital, many people know of this case, to the hospital's credit, they actually went into the community to find out why. Why are women not accessing primary care? And that's how they found out that it was about the gowns. What they did was they actually went to the people who actually provide them with their scrubs and had something designed that was more modest that women would feel comfortable wearing. And the increase, we were also talking last night about, you know, how do you make this case on a broader scale as opposed to individual sessions? Well, one thing is that you had less people going into the emergency room because more people were coming in for primary care because that obstacle had been removed from them actually accessing primary care. Hygiene. A nurse cuts the beard, eyebrows, and mustache of an elderly sick patient, not realizing that it is a sick religious practice to keep long hair. And in this particular case, the family was very concerned that the father not be shaved, and they had actually posted a little sign at the end of his bed that advised people, you know, please don't cut his hair. The nurses on staff knew of, you know, he had been there for some time, they knew of what was going on, and they said, you know, you really don't have to do the sign because we're aware of what's going on, and, you know, we're not going to cut his hair. A new nurse came on rotation, did not know the traditions, had not spoken with anyone, and cut his hair. And then the family sued the hospital and won. And it wasn't a huge financial award, but one of the parts of the settlement was that they actually had to undergo some kind of training around, in particular in this case, the requirements of sick people in terms of why they keep hair long. And they're not the only tradition that have that belief system. Observance of holy days and rituals. The husband of a Muslim patient washing his hands and feet in the restroom before prayer in a hospital is accosted by a security guard who thinks he's homeless. And this was another case where they ultimately sued, but the patient family lost because the actions of the security guard were seen as somewhat appropriate given what he thought was going on. But it did not, it severely damaged the hospital's reputation to the Muslim community. And again, you know, there is a case to be made for the bottom line financial implications of when you're a hospital or healthcare institution with a bad rep. Okay, I'm going to move a little quickly. Social worker is asked to speak to the parents of a newborn baby after staff become concerned that the Hindu couple is not bonding with the baby because they refuse to fill in the baby's name on the birth forms. They don't realize that some Hindus will wait to name the baby until he or she is 7 days old. And again, no communication, just assumptions, operating on assumption that this family is not bonding with their child. Dietary requirements, a nurse seeing the beard and turban of a patient takes the initiative to order him a halal meal. She is confused when the patient refuses to eat, not realizing that he is sick and not Muslim. And for many sick patients, they will not eat food that's been ritually prepared by other traditions. So they won't eat kosher meals. They won't eat halal meals. And it was, and I think the other thing, too, about this whole area is that often we see people have the best of intention. This person was trying to provide patient-centered care, but missed the step of actually asking the patient, what do you need? So some recommendations to know your patient population and to know the changes that are going on in your patient population, and perhaps not wait until they come to the door, but to actually examine what's going on in the area around the hospital. Who's moving in? What houses of worship are they seeing larger people, larger numbers of attendants? Educate yourself and staff and commit to lifelong learning, because if you remember the slide that has all of the traditions on it, there's no way any of us could know all of that. But what we can do is train ourselves to be able to communicate respectfully and effectively with people about their religious beliefs or their non-beliefs. Using spiritual assessments, we'll talk about that more a little bit later, but spiritual assessments not as a checklist, but as a way to really gather information that doesn't stay on one chart, but is carried through the patient's stay if it's in a hospital or throughout their time, and checking in on that, because religiosity changes. It's not static. Simply because I come to you and fill out a form and say I'm Christian, a year later that could change. Assign responsibility for conducting routine spiritual assessments and follow through. Who does that fall to? Or who are the people within the team or within the treatment experience does that fall to? Never assume, and we say that all the time about a variety of things, but certainly in this regard it's important. And start somewhere. Often people say to us, well, where do we start? Start somewhere. Start somewhere, and we'll talk a little bit in some of the other presentations about some of the places you might consider starting.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.